Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. After a 2 or 3 week hiatus, we were gone for 2 weeks while the repeater was being repaired. And tonight we've got some exciting subjects. When we get to Paul, you'll hear about two spacecraft that are doing exciting things out there. Two separate spacecraft, one American and one Chinese. When Roy gives us his presentation on Science Talk, one of the things that Roy is most famous for is his quizzes, his puzzles. If you go to the Kings County Radio Club and you look up Roy's TechNet that he runs there for the last couple of years, he's got some very exciting puzzles. He's going to be giving you one tonight. I think one of the puzzles he's going to give you, I think, is on the subject of an elevator. And some of you guys, it's going to drive crazy. Almost as much as is an endothermic or an exothermic reaction when ice melts, as we had a couple of weeks ago. Let me drop. As you guys have heard so far, so many times, main purpose of the TechNet is technical information, education. Ham Radio University, which was held today, also has an awful lot of education. Roy was involved in that, and I'm going to hope that Roy will describe a little bit about what he did when he and Andy, WA2CDL, were giving people a hands-on, so to speak, demonstration of test equipment. What do those signals on the screen mean, and how do you interpret them? Hopefully, Roy will give us a little bit of a description of how that worked out. And from what I can tell, that presentation at 1 o'clock or 1:30 was well appreciated. A person signs into the TechNet. Let me drop. You sign in by giving this crew your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. If you're just listening, people have been listening for 36 years, you don't have to prove to us that you're listening. We accept that after 36 years, the fact that the TechNet is still here. The mistakes that people make is they forget to give me their name. I'm so forgetful that I need a name, because I like referring to people by name, just not just call letters. You know, back to you. I'd like to say back to John. Also, people forget to wait for the beeps, and they time out the machine. So when it comes to your turn to be selected, people get excited and squeeze the mic real fast before the beeps, and sometimes they time out the machine. The first section of the TechNet is where people sign in because they do have a question or a comment for the net, and we take them in order. Let me drop. Depending on the amount of enthusiasm, that section can be as short as half an hour or as long as 2 hours. We go with the flow. If there's a whole lot of people with a whole lot of exciting questions, then we keep running the question and answer section. That's followed by Roy, AC2GS. Dr. Roy gives us a science talk, some interesting science articles, puzzles, all kinds of good stuff. Roy likes as much participation as you can give him, so butt in periodically and give him guesses. Don't worry about making a bad guess. The whole philosophy of the TechNet is there's no such thing as a bad guess or a bad question. A bad question means there's a larger gap between what the guy knows and what he wants to know. So we don't reject people because of that minor problem, minor temporary problem. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, with the space report. And China has been doing some very interesting things, and the United States has been doing some very interesting things with spacecraft in the last couple of weeks. You're going to be hearing about those. So, we're going to go back to the beginning, and you guys are going to sign in right now, one at a time, sign up to double on top of each other. Call letters, name, wait for the beeps, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. So give me your call letters and name right now after the beeps. K2RIW, you're listening. We got Rich. Anyone else? We got Joe and Rich. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
N2EO, just saying hello from South Carolina.
Okay, yeah. Wes, are you signing in, Wes? Because you do have a question, and we did get N2MB from South Carolina. And hopefully you'll come back, Barry, with a real question. WA2BIT is what he used to be known as. So, Wes, on a quick yes or no. You're signing in because you do have a question, Wes. Go ahead, Wes.
Yes.
Mr. Dodger. Okay, so we got Joe, Rich, Wes. Anyone else to sign in because you do have a question or a comment for the debt? Give me your call letters and name right now.
C2CJEN. What miracles did Eric perform over the last 2 weeks, over?
Okay. So we'd like to have Eric describe what took place. Now, Eric is on the way out to New Jersey. He's out of range, so maybe he's not going to be able to do that. So because he's traveling right now, and we can still hear him, let's give it a try. KE2EJ, is there anything you want to describe as to what you did to bring this beautiful repeater back up to working condition? KE2EJ, I hope we can hear you. K2RIW in the TechNet. Yeah, possibly we waited a little bit too long, Ed. He was traveling west when I talked to him earlier to do a repair out there in the hinterland. So I'll give you my guess later on as to what I think took place. I've got some of the story, and the other people listening maybe will correct me. We're going to go back to Joe, to B2OYY, who's had this burning question for a couple of weeks that he's wanted to ask us, and now he's got his chance. You've got it, Joe. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Did K2KND with info about the antenna, if you'd like?
Go right ahead, Rich.
So, basically what happened was the antenna took a lightning strike, apparently on December 21st. But it took us a couple of days to realize that we had to get up on the roof of Glen Oaks to be able to check it out. Glen Oaks is a very private area. Only certain people are allowed to actually go up on the roof. And the landlord's agreement with Glen Oaks is that no one can go up on the roof between Christmas and New Year's. So we didn't expect the problem to last as long. The first week, the repeater was out completely. Let me let it drop. When we realized that it was going to take longer because we couldn't get to the roof, one of our good friends rearranged his own repeater to take the link frequency from Glen Oaks and put that through his repeater as receiving on UHF and then retransmitting on 85. Coverage was good, not obviously quite as good as we would have normally, but that lasted us for a few days. Then they finally got up on the roof. The base of the antenna was burned out. Again, the most likely culprit being a lightning strike, which would be twice in the same year that we had a lightning strike. They replaced it with a slightly shorter antenna temporarily to see what the results would be, but I do believe we will go back to the full-sized antenna and the normal coverage that we would have. This is K2KNB.
And that's K2KNB, the president of the club, Rich. You may not know, but make a guess. The full replacement of the Station Master-like antenna, the one that got struck with lightning, to bring the station back up to the 100% level. I'm going to say it now at the 95% level. Make a rough guess as to when that might take place, Rich. Are we talking about a week, a month, 3 months? K2KNB, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
The antenna that we use comes from Commander Technologies. I believe they're somewhere in the south. Normal delivery time is about 3 weeks. The last time this happened, we had access to one and then we just replaced it. I don't believe we have that same ability. So approximately 3 weeks. However, we are in the process of filing an insurance claim also. But regardless, whether we get insurance or not, it should be 3 weeks approximately. And then, of course, Dick, they will probably have to get riggers to bring it up up to the top of the roof. So figure something between 3 and 4 weeks.
Yeah, I think the station master that we're talking about is in the vicinity of 18 feet long, which I think it means it cannot be brought up by the elevator, although I guess there's a slim possibility you could stick it up through, remove one of the tiles in the top of the elevator and stick the antenna in there and maybe you can squeeze it in. If not, the antenna has to be hauled up on the outside of the building, a rather big operation. Is that the way it was done the last time, Eric? I mean, Josh, here we go. Rich, K2KNB, K2IW.
K2IW.
Oh, we're hearing you right now, Eric, so please go.
Yeah, well, I'm not convinced we need to go to a bigger antenna because, I mean, we still got to map out what works and what doesn't. The antenna has to be brought up the staircase. It's incredibly annoying. We cannot move anything on the outside of the building. They will not submit it.
That makes some sense. But if you remove one of the tiles in the top of the elevator, and I know that ham clubs have done crazy things like that, and you have to do a study ahead of time that when the elevator is at the top, or maybe you only bring it up to the one floor from the top, so to speak, you have to worry about the antenna sticking through the top of the elevator, still striking something inside the elevator shaft. So, in theory, in fact, the original antenna, the one that just got struck with lightning, how did that antenna get there, Eric? KE2EJ, K2IW.
It was very painfully brought up by the staircase. It was walked up. Taking the old antenna down to the same point, and because one particular person had to bring them down, cut them up into small pieces.
Understand, so it can be walked up the staircase. That sounds like a lot of hand-over-hand operations as you bring it up in between the individual floors of the staircase. And that can get it all the way to the top. Beautiful operation. So is it possible that might take place again, Eric? Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, if we choose to change the antenna out again. I'm not at this point convinced it's necessary, but we'll see. As far as bringing it up in the elevator, that's another building will not permit happen. Although, when the World Trade Center went down, that's exactly what we did at Empire. I mean, the antenna wouldn't even fit inside the elevator. We put it on top of the elevator.
Wow. That means you have to bring the elevator down below a floor in order to get to the top of the elevator. It also means that when the antenna, when the elevator is at the top of its shaft, you have to worry about whether or not it's going to touch something in the so-called ceiling of the elevator shaft when the elevator is all the way up. Give you a couple of words on how you make sure that all goes smoothly and you don't kill people standing on top of the elevator. Over to you, Eric.
Now, at Empire, we had two guys, both infected, both very big, coming out as they got onto the antenna on top of the elevator. Actually, there's a basement floor, so it wasn't a problem making the top of the elevator level with the floor landing and doing the same thing when we took it off.
It sounds to me like that technique gets you one floor from the top, that the elevator, when it's at the highest it can possibly go, I'm guessing an 18-foot antenna on the roof of the elevator on the outside, would strike something inside the building. So maybe you only bring the elevator up one floor from the top of the building. Over to you, Eric.
Now, when I put the antennas on Empire, they were considered to be standbys. That was X number of days after the World Trade Center went. We were already operating from Alpine, and the high seas were much of it. So we wound up putting it on the 81st floor setback, and so the elevator stopped on the top of the elevator was level with the 81st floor landing, and it was a service elevator. It was only one service elevator, so things worked out quite well.
81st floor, that makes a lot of sense, where the building, I think, has got 102 floors, Empire. Now, could you use that procedure at Glen Oak to go to the top of the building, or would you have to stop one floor from the top of the building with the antenna on top of the elevator shaft? Go ahead.
No, that could be done. Actually, there's a whole other floor's worth of space between the top floor and where the elevator motors, lunge its cable through.
But anyway, the building won't permit that, so don't even think about it. Okay, so walking it up the stairs is the way it's going to be done. Thank you for all this information, Eric. Anything else you want to tell us? KE2EJ, I think in New Jersey. K2RIW in the tech man.
Yeah, I'm in Jersey City, I'm all near the radio station. Let's see. I mean, we went through a bunch of stuff trying to figure out what it was without actually being able to get up there, but, you know, I made my findings and then somebody double-checked him and agreed with them. And eventually we got to the work for the agreement that the leasing company and the building had about the building being on the roof between the areas.
Very good, Eric. Thank you for all the information. You're starting to get a little bit noisy. You're dropping out about 20% of the time. Okay, now once again, we're going to go back to Joe, K2RIY, with his exciting question that he had for a couple of weeks. You got it, Joe. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. K2RIY. This question is, even though it may sound commercial, I'm really interested more in the theory behind it in the application than considering its commercial usage, okay? And I'll give you some just, you know, some permission information to go by so you have, like, you can draw a picture. Say you want to cover a building with a building repeater. You want to put an in-building repeater. You're not going to use slotted coax, okay? So say that's out because of the expense, but you want to put an antenna at, say, floor 5, floor 10, and floor 15, either in the corner of the building or at one of the sides of the building. All right? I guess you got that so far, right?
Yes, I do. So an in-building repeater system or an in-building, I call that a RF irrigating system. You're irrigating the inside of the building with RF. And because of the amount of attenuation between the floors, you can't just do it with an antenna outside the building or an antenna inside the building on any one floor. So you're going to put an antenna in this proposal on floor number 5, floor number 10, and floor number 15 is what I'm hearing so far. Over to you, Joe, K2RIW.
I'm a big fan of Radiax. What's wrong with that?
No need to get off on tangents, because you're saying it's not going to be used for the purpose of this question, okay? Because you'll end up getting off on a left-hand tangent, and you'll need a first of my time.
Well, temporarily, we won't use Radiax, but I think Eric is right. This application, Radiax properly used, could irrigate the inside of that building. But for the time being, we'll not use Radiax. You want to do it with three individual antennas and three individual floors. We'll discuss that at first. Go ahead, Joe.
Good. Now that you understand the basic concept, okay, the question is sort of like two questions related to this one particular topic. One is going to be matching the antenna systems so you end up with a low VSWR on your transmit frequency, especially because you're paralleling three antennas, okay? I believe each antenna would probably have to, if I'm wrong, assuming this, then correct me, but each antenna would have to have an impedance effectively as it attaches with, say, a T-connector to the main transmission line of something like 150 ohms. Parallel three antennas gives you an impedance of 50 ohms. So matching is one question. The other part of the question is, would you be better off using, say, for simplicity, using a dipole type of antenna, which has a fairly wide pattern? You could take the dipoles and make them go vertically. You could take the dipoles and make them go horizontally, or you could take the dipoles and put, like, say, the top floor, 15th floor number 15, tilted left hand, 45 degrees. The one at floor 10, tilted right hand, 45 degrees. And the one at floor 5, tilted left at 15, at 45 degrees. So, what do you think would be the better as far as, take it in a reverse order, as far as coverage? Using the antennas vertically polarized, horizontally polarized, or with a staggered type of pattern where it's at 45 degrees each antenna, offset by the next one.
Now, this is a rather peculiar question you're asking, Joe. And you just happened to hit exactly the right person, I think. I did that experiment. roughly 1995 at Airborne Instruments Laboratory in Deer Park, a three-story building if you include the basement, I experimented with VHF antennas at 900 megacycles, horizontally polarized, vertically polarized, slant polarized, circular polarized, on various floors while irrigating the inside of that building with a radar-like system. And I measured the amplitude and time delay of the echoes of the building. I really built a radar system. It was only running at the 10-watt level, but I was only looking at the echoes from the building that was, maximum a couple hundred feet away, horizontally, vertically, whatever. What I immediately discovered is that when you're inside of a building with an antenna, and you realize that every antenna radiates a signal in all possible directions, every single object in that environment gets hit with RF energy. Floor, ceiling, file cabinet, desks, fountain pens, plumbing in the wall, wiring in the floor, all of that jazz. That environment, there is no such thing as polarization. Let me drop. You think your transmitting antenna is transmitting a horizontally polarized signal from the inside of the building. You stand 30 feet away from that antenna and make measurements. You'll find every possible polarization in the world because there's zillions of signals bouncing all over inside that building. So you don't have to worry about polarization. No matter what polarization you use, circular, linear, slant linear, horizontal, vertical, it's going to become randomized. As you have a handy talkie in your hand, so to speak, and you are standing 20 feet away from the transmitting antenna, your transmitting antenna is down the hall, and you're 20 or 30 feet away, and you hold the antenna, your handy talkie, horizontal, vertical, pointing, the rubber duck pointing at the antenna, and then you translate your handy talkie a little bit in X, Y, and Z, and you'll find out you need a brand new orientation to peak it up. So there's random polarizations all over the place. So when you're irrigating a building, use whatever polarization is your favorite. It doesn't matter. They're all going to become randomized. That's the first part of your question. And do we need any amplification for that before we go to the next part, which is a little bit easier? WHRYY, good technical question. KQRIW, been there, done that.
Negative. No, nothing else needed as a filter for that. That's fine. You can proceed to the next part as far as matching all three of your antennas to the transmission line. QGZ.
Go ahead, Bill. Maybe you have a question on what we've said so far. And maybe you've lived with this multipath crazy situation the way RF really behaves. You got it, Bill.
Yeah, so, WQGZ. First choice for me would probably be Radiax, but we're not talking about that, so I didn't say it. Do a lot of in-building stuff at work, so if I'm doing a passive system like that, I typically feed it either with a power divider on the bottom and three coax runs to the individual antennas and find a riser going up, or another thing you can do is just run a line straight up to your top antenna and put directional couplers so that you can kind of control the amount of power at each antenna. Because one of the other concerns with the in-buildings, especially when you're hanging antennas in places, is the electromagnetic exposure, for which there are some standards you have to meet for folks that are working in the area of those antennas during the day. And that's a concern if you're taking a 20-watt or a 50-watt base station and splitting it amongst three antennas in an occupied area indoors.
Yeah, that's a very crafty way of doing it. One piece of cable running up the building with directional couplers put at various levels. The nice thing about a directional coupler is it samples some of the power flowing down the cable and puts it out of a third connector. A directional coupler can be a 10 dB, 20 dB, 6 dB, 3 dB. If it was a 6 dB directional coupler, that means 6 dB is a 4-to-1 ratio. That means of all the power flowing down the center of the directional coupler along that vertical line, one quarter of that power is sucked out and sent to the third port where you can put an antenna. So directional couplers and by adjusting the directional couplers to be 3, 6, 9, 12, 20 dB, and so on, you can adjust the power that's put to the antenna at each level. That's a very crafty, well impedance match technique. Let me drop. In Joe's case, where he is feeding, in his case, only three antennas, floor number 5, floor number 10, floor number 15, he could put the transmitter on floor number 10 and have a 2-to-1 power divider coming out of the transmitter with one cable going, a 3-to-1 power divider. One of the ports goes with the cable going vertically up to the 15th floor. One of the ports goes to at port number 3. Port number 1 goes to a piece of cable going down to floor number 5. And port number 2 goes to the antenna on floor number 10. So that's another way of doing it. The impedance matching portion of it that you're worried about, Joe, to a person who understands impedance matching, that's a fairly simple problem. As long as the whole system is on one frequency region. If the system is on, if it's got to cover multiple bands, life gets complicated. But as long as it's a, you know, one frequency band that's only a few percent wide, various ways of splitting the power and making the impedance match come out correctly. Even at worst, if you use a dumb T connector at that transmitter on floor number 10, which means a 50-ohm cable going up and a 50-ohm cable going down is going to give you 25 ohms, and you load the transmitter with 25 ohms, on the T-connector. That's only a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. If that transmitter is robust enough, particularly if it's a solid state with some hair on its chest, it would just laugh at you, and it would do that continuously. And you could put a quarter-wave matching transformer in there, a piece of a 70-ohm cable, a quarter-wavelength long, to the transmitter that brings the 25 ohms back up to 50. 37 ohms, yeah, that's the right number, 37 ohm piece of quarter-wave. Lots of ways of doing the impedance matching. That's the easy part. There's another spooky thing about the system. Let me drop. Because I had built a radar system, and I built this radar system with nanosecond pulsing, each of my transmitted pulses were a few nanoseconds long. I was looking at the echo in the building. I could have the transmitting antenna 30 feet away from me. Each pulse coming out of the transmitter, going through 30 feet into my receiver, would be delayed by roughly 30 nanoseconds. Nanosecond per foot is the speed of light. So with 30 nanosecond delay, I expected to see a pulse at my receiver. And I did have a timing cable between the transmitter and the receiver, so I knew when the pulses were supposed to arrive. The spooky thing is that with that system, I was seeing echoes in the building, not for 30 nanoseconds, for about 250 nanoseconds. Some of the signals coming out of the transmitter antenna went north in the building a couple of hundred feet and then echoed back to me. Some of those signals went south a couple of hundred feet in the building, east a couple of hundred feet, left a couple of hundred feet, and then reflected off something and came back to me. I saw echoes for a healthy 250 nanoseconds in that building. That gives you some funny feelings as to what's going on because of the multipath. The multipath is in the let's call it the three-dimensional domain, X, Y, and Z, the signals going out and reflecting on something and coming to you, and they're all being summed together at your receiving antenna. Let me drop. They're all being summed together at your receiving antenna, even though each individual echo has a different magnitude and a different shift in phase, and they're all being added together in a vector delay manner, in a vector manner. But there's also an additional multiple wavelength, 250 wavelengths, so to speak, time delay on some of those echoes. So some of the echoes are arriving to you 25 wavelengths downrange in time and still coming into your summing point. So the echoes in the building is really something. One of the things you got to worry a little bit about, when you have an antenna on floor number 5, 10, and 15, and you're standing on floor number 12, you're going to be picking up a fairly strong signal from floor number 10 and a slightly weaker signal from floor number 15. As you move that handy-talkie vertically, some of those signals from floor number 10 and floor number 15 will be falling in phase and out of phase. You would think you would get a whole lot of crazy nulls. Because the building is lit up with so many thousands of signals bouncing off so many things, you can't find a null. as long as you've got a high enough transmitter power. I only needed a watt of power, because the maximum range was, you know, some number of hundreds of feet. A watt of power, which is not very much as far as radio frequency biohazard is concerned, as long as the transmitting antenna is not sitting on somebody's desk a foot away from his mouth, it's hard to run into a biohazard problem. And with a reasonably sensitive receiver, you'll find echoes all over the place. It would be very difficult to position the handy talkie with a well-designed system such that you get a deep no and wouldn't get any reception at that particular square inch where you locate the handy talkie. You're starting to get some of the picture of what happens when you irrigate the center of a building. It is one hell of a big echo chamber. Radio
repeater, timeout.
Radio-wise, it's the equivalent of a circus effect. If you're in a room that has a zillion mirrors and you're doing optical reflections, you've got some idea of what it would look like. Radio-wise, that's what's going on. W2RYY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
W2RYY. All right, so you're thinking of things to say like an analog world. Say perhaps that this is a UHF repeater, so you have to be able to transmit and receive through the system, and in one form, maybe you're talking about analog. Now, what if you're using a digital system? Would you actually get any kind of cancellation between floors or situations where the two signals are fighting each other and actually tending to partially cancel the signal out between floors? Would that, you think that would happen at all in a digital world compared to analog? Back to you.
In the case of digital television, on an ideal setup, where the signal is coming from the Empire State Building, I'm out here 30-some-odd miles away from it, and the main path is the dominant path. There's a whole lot of paths that try to bounce off the ground, but they're not very effective in my case, because I've got 80-foot-high trees. Those signals all get attenuated. The main reflecting signal comes from the Dix Hills Water Tower. The echo from the Dix Hills Water Tower gives me some number of nanoseconds of delay, which at the rate of the digital pulsing of that digital television signal is X number of pulses downrange. So you're getting into symbol distortion. If I don't carefully position my antenna by aiming it correctly so that the nulls of the antenna pattern of my receiving antenna are not aimed at that water tower, which is only a fraction of a mile from me, that multipath into symbol distortion destroys the reception. The television converter lights up saying weak signal. What's really getting is it's getting a high error rate and it can't tolerate it. Let me drop. So whenever you've got a modern day fast digital signal, like you've got with digital television, I think only a couple of nanoseconds of delay is going to make the echo, the second signal coming into the receiver, one of the sub-pulses downrange, and you're going to get into symbol distortion. It's going to drive the system crazy. There are some very elaborate receiving converters which can tolerate some number of multiple signals at some number of nanoseconds of delay, but there is a limit. If you were doing this inside of a building with fast pulsing, that inter-symbol distortion time delay is going to drive you crazy. If the pulsing is done at a slow enough rate so that all the echoes die down in between each digital pulse and sub-pulse, it would work like a charm. But when you start going to real high data rates, everybody wants with a fifth-generation system, we want to transmit 100 megabits per second, if you know what I mean. Very fast digital rates. To irrigate an inside of a building and be able to keep that signal working correctly, in my opinion, is going to be very difficult. It may become slightly impossible unless you've got a very elaborate converter that can tolerate multiple signals with a what's called a transversal filter technique in the time domain, where it literally, you could say, takes out all of the all the delayed echoes, you could say. In reality, what it's doing is it's putting in the right amount of time delay so that all of the delayed echoes come out in phase. But it takes a very elaborate system to do that. It's going to take some pretty high-class smarts to do it on the inside of a building at high data rates, in my opinion, Joe. darn good question. That's a very different
repeater. Time out.
Don, good question. That's a very difficult area. Back to Joe first, then we'll pick up the other person. W2LYY, K2IW, wait for the beeps, I didn't.
K-E-2-E-J.
Oh, you found another way in. Okay. Well, say you're not transferring a very high data rate using just some sort of voice digital technology, which doesn't require a very fast data rate. You still think you have a problem as you get on some of the floors between the antennas. Back to you.
Yeah, your audio analog information is occurring at a millisecond rate, and the echoes you're getting from the building are at tens of nanoseconds delay. So audio, I think, can be done. But high-speed video and high-speed data, I think, is going to be very troublesome. But the guy who's on the leading edge of this is Eric, KE2EJ, and I'll bet you we're going to find out that the 15th generation of a digital demodulator, particularly with the new system that's coming up, can possibly tolerate inside of the building irrigation with zillions of multipaths. KE2EJ, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric.
KE2EJ.
Hello. Okay. First of all, can you hear me? I hope so. I'm on echoing right now.
Yes, Eric. Yes, Eric, we're hearing you on EchoLink. Unfortunately, the EchoLink has no response beyond 1 kilohertz. It's a very bassy audio. Speak carefully. I think we'll figure out what you're saying. I sure wish you had a peaking control for the high pitch that you're putting into that EchoLink. Over to you, Eric.
Well, I'm using a really lousy setup here. The point that I want to make is that inside a building, if you're doing more than 100 megabits of service, you can go split spectrum, which kind of eliminates a lot of the problems because you can literally flip frequencies based on bit rates, so you can get past some of that. There's a number of different methodologies like CRFM, which is somewhat tolerant. With the ECFP, the equalizer is really kind of capable of 50 nanoseconds in that neighborhood, which is multiple interval spacing. The new format, which is called CRFM, it's got actually 1,024 carriers, and you can get away with a lot of stuff. You can isolate between reflections and what the actual true signal is by taking various different carriers and comparing them. So there are a number of solutions. But if you're just talking about high-speed data within a building, forget about television. I mean, television, we're looking to get 20 megabits without errors. So, we pack up and see it, and because of that, there's a limit to how far we can go. But if you're just talking data like your Wi-Fi, I mean, you've got Wi-Fi that's capable of, 100, 200 megabits worth of stuff in the desert via the way it's spectrum by swap and frequencies all around, not being in one particular place at any one particular time. So, CRIW,
yeah, the audio you're giving us, Eric, has got about 15 or 20% harmonic intermodulation distortion of the audio. It has no response beyond 1 kilohertz, and it's doing some flat tapping besides. So you got to speak slowly. We got about 80% copy. I had the impression that you said that COFDM is reasonably tolerant, the new European system that we're going to be switching over to. 8VSB is going to have a lot of trouble with video. COFDM apparently can handle this with 1,000 carriers, so to speak. It's a little bit like a multiple input, multiple output. WIMO, I guess they call it. MIMO? Yeah, MIMO. So it can be done, but I think you're saying to do it with high-speed, high-definition video inside the building, I think you're saying even with COFDM, it's going to be a bit of a challenge. Please speak softly and slowly because of the amount of distortion and the lack of high-frequency sibilance in your voice. It takes a fair amount of mental processing, even with my earphones on, to figure out each one of your words. KE2EJ, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2J. This is probably a lot better. I was using a
a Bluetooth headset that really doesn't have a good audio response. Is this better?
That's a little bit better. Speak softly because you're flat tapping a little bit.
Okay. This should be better then. My point is this. With the CRFDM, you'll have a better chance of dealing with reflections. Because you're transmitting 1024Ks and actually 2048, depending upon the mode that they're transmitting. The interesting thing about ATSC3 is that it isn't one RF standard. There's multiple standards that can be used. It'll be pretty much up to the discretion of the broadcaster, which also will control the amount of bandwidth, blah, 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 so on and so forth. ATSB, the equalizer, is pretty much good for about 50 to 100 nanoseconds, which is multiple symbols across. But even still, with big jumps, they have a problem. Ultimately, within a building, the best way to get high data rates inside a building is to use this spread spectrum. Spread spectrum can actually be hopping at the symbol rate, meaning that you're essentially decoding each symbol per frequency, which is really kind of fast, although we don't actually do it at that rate. We do it at slower rates, but your Wi-Fi, your 5-gig Wi-Fi, your 2.4-gig Wi-Fi have the capability with certain kinds of compression to do 100 megabits worth of data, which is just very commonplace today. So, I mean, there are solutions. It's not an impossible thing. Well, that's another thing where Radiax actually does a good job in distributing data. I use it in studios and places like that, specifically because rather than to have to get into figuring out time domain routine places, the propagation delay between each one of those holes, depending upon where you are, will be the strongest signal, and the reflections are not going to bother you. K2RIW, KQEJ.
Yeah, properly used Radiax can work easier, better in this situation, because the signal coming out of the slots in the Radiax for, let's say, a 50-foot length, each of those signals is close to the same magnitude. Each of those slots is a kind of, let me pick a number, a 30-decibel directional coupler, so to speak. And so the portion of the Radiax cable that's nearest to you is giving the majority of the signal into your receiver. The portions of the Radiax that are further uprange and downrange from you, you almost don't hear them. And so Radiax is an easier way to go. One simple cable in the building, properly installed vertically in the building between all the floors, might do it. But Joe wants to discuss doing it with individual antennas. And it can be done, but it's a bit challenging in some circumstances, particularly with high-speed data, as you can hear, Joe. W2RYY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, so you covered the matching. The matching would, you'd have to use something like a different piece of cable at maybe less than a quarter wave length and length, electrically, to match the antenna to the transmission line system. So that seems to make some sense that way. And the rest makes sense also, as far as polarization. I don't know. I don't know enough about it as far as, you know, how much a digital signal would tolerate, transmitting and receiving through the system if you're actually between floors. I don't know. Okay, that's enough. Enough of this one. You can go on to the next guy. Next question. Thanks, W2RYY.
Many people make the mistake of thinking that because a repeater, for instance, puts out a vertical signal, that no matter where you stand in the environment, 1 mile away, 10 miles away, 30 miles away, so you get enough signal above threshold into your receiving system. You think because the transmitter is vertical, you're always going to get a vertical signal. Absolutely not. The best example I can give you is that you've got a handheld mirror lying on the table. You're sitting on the south side of the table, your buddy is sitting on the north side of the table, and in the middle of the table you've got this mirror. And you look into the mirror, and you see the reflection of your buddy, but he is inverted. That's step number one. Hold the mirror at eye level in your left hand to the east or the west. Don't forget now that you are south on the south end of the table. He's on the north end of the table. You're holding the mirror on the east end of the table, and you're orienting the mirror just right so you can see his reflection. In that mirror, you'll see his reflection. But he is now not reversed up and down. He's not upside down. He's now reversed left to right. So a mirror can do that. Now, if you hold the mirror halfway between those two situations, you're holding it toward the east, but down below eye level. The mirror is at a 45-degree angle, so to speak. And now you look at the reflection of your buddy in the mirror. Your vertically polarized buddy will look horizontally polarized in that mirror. He'll look like he's laying down. You're now learning about chirality. A general reflection off of a reflecting device at a crazy orientation will reverse things left to right, top to bottom, or rotate polar...
Repeater, timeout.
So in the real world, you get a lot of polarization rotation. You run that experiment, you hold a handy-talkie in your room, and you listen to your favorite weak repeater, one that's at a pretty good range. And you hold the handy-talkie horizontal, vertical, point the rubber duck at the repeater. In other words, you orient the rubber duck of the handy-talkie in the X-plane, the Y-plane, or the Z-plane, and you simultaneously translate the handy-talkie in X, Y, and Z directions. You'll find all kinds of crazy places where you get peaks and valleys and nulls at funny polarizations. When I listen to this repeater in the morning with my handy-talkie in my bathroom, I put the handy-talkie on a wooden shelf, and I get the strongest signal when my handy-talkie is laying flat, horizontal. If I put my handy-talkie vertical, I get a weaker signal. That signal, when it arrives in my bathroom, the signal from this repeater is horizontally polarized because of the multiple reflections of my house, my environment, and so on. I get a different effect when I do it in my living room versus my bathroom. Let me drop. So in the real world, in real environments, with rare exception, there's a tremendous amount of multipath, and polarization becomes, in many cases, pretty randomized. Polarization becomes randomized, as well as signal strength becoming randomized. When I was traveling up to Rome, New York, near Utica, Rome Air Development Center, for a whole lot of weekends, I had two antennas on my station wagon while I'm traveling up there. One was a horizontally polarized, I can't even think of the name of the damn thing, and a vertically polarized whip. And I had two cables coming into the car with a relay in the car, and I could flip back and forth between the horizontal antenna on the roof of my car and the vertical. And I was talking to a guy who was in southern New Jersey with a kilowatt and four Yagis on 2 meters on the top of 100 feet of tower while I'm traveling up to 200 miles away from him up to Utica. And I'm in the marble canyons of the New York State Thruway listening to his single sideband signal. He sounded the same to me. He was transmitting horizontally polarized out of these four Yagis. And whether I listened to him horizontal or vertically polarized, he sounded the same when I'm on the roadbed of the New York State Thruway. Let me drop. But when I get up to a scenic overlook where I could see 20 miles, then the horizontal signal gave me a direct, horizontal antenna gave me a definitely stronger signal than the vertical. So when I got into the environment where the direct signal was the strongest, the favored polarization worked quite a bit better than the unfavored polarization. But down in the roadbed of the New York State Thruway, where the signal was getting to me by sifting through trees and buildings and water towers and houses and everything else, the polarization was thoroughly random. So in the real world of multipath, in most environments, polarization is not sacred. It gets randomized. And you're getting a zillion signals coming to your receiving system simultaneously. Anybody any further questions on this particular subject? There's a lot more to it than you've heard so far. K2LIW listening. Okay, the next person who signed in with a question or a comment, non-political, non-medical, but only radio-like question. It's going to be Rich, N2EO. N2EO, go ahead, Rich, K2LIW. Maybe Rich got called away on his telephone, so I'm going to go over to Wes, and then we'll come back to Rich. N2XJN, K2LIW, go ahead, Wes.
Thank you very much, Dick. I have two questions. I need to create a vertically polarized wave, and I need to find if it's vertically polarized towards the ground. Second question, I need to know the phase relation of the signal. So the one way of doing it is for a vector voltmeter, but the one that I have, Hewlett-Packard 8405A, works from 100 kilohertz. I need something lower than that. Let me drop. So one of way that I know of is I'm simply pricking or punching the probe from the voltmeter into the coaxial cable next to the antenna, and I would be able to find out what is the phase at this particular point. So first, I need to know how to create vertically polarized wave, and that's for Tesla coil. Thank you.
Okay, there's a lot of missing information here, Wes. You want to create a vertically polarized signal at a particular location, if I understand correctly. In other words, you want to feed a radio frequency signal, vertically polarized. You want to transmit it from point X, and you want it to be received, so to speak, at your Tesla coil, if I understand correctly. Is that your question, over to you, Wes?
No, my transmitting structure is a Tesla coil, so I'm feeding the generator to the primer of Tesla coil. And from the Tesla coil out, the high voltage coil, there is one wire on the top that is connected to the capacitor. By changing the hatch of that capacitor up and down, I'm creating a vertically polarized signal. So that could be named vertically polarized antenna. I need to know if it's vertically polarized.
Yeah, my best guess, Wes, is that the signal coming out of a Tesla coil, which is going to be a very random spark, it's a spark transmitter.
No. Regular generator at the frequency X, 100 kilohertz, 500 kilohertz, small power. I need to know that this signal is in space vertically polarized. It means the antenna is acting as vertically polarizing the signal.
Okay, right now it sounds like you are pulsing the primary coil of the Tesla coil at a 100 kilohertz rate. Is the Tesla coil making a spark transmitted signal out of the top of the Tesla coil? Are you getting a lightning-like signal? Are you getting a fuzzy blue signal out of the top of the Tesla coil? Go ahead.
No, not yet. It's a theoretical question. I feed with one particular frequency. It's not going to be spark transmitter that is going to be messing up from 0 to 1.5 gigahertz. It's going to be one particular frequency. The requirement is create a vertically polarized signal compared to the ground. So vertically polarized antenna, how do I measure if it's vertically polarized?
You use a polarimeter. What is a polarimeter? One way of doing it is to have a receiving antenna that is linear polarized, like a Yagi or like a horn. It could be a Yagi, a dipole. And you measure the signal strength coming out of the dipole as you rotate the dipole in polarization. when that dipole doing the receiving is vertically polarized, you're going to get the strongest signal. When the dipole is horizontally polarized, you're going to get a weaker signal, not zero, because that primary winding at the bottom of your Tesla coil is horizontally polarized. So every real antenna is not pure. We can talk about, in your particular case, maybe 90% of the energy is going to be vertically polarized, and maybe 10% of it is going to be horizontally polarized. I think that's part of the answer you're looking for. Very few antennas are absolutely pure. Only a well-designed feed horn can be absolutely pure in polarization. N2XJN, KQLIW.
Okay, so I understand that polarimeter is a structure that I can build that could be just a coil that is connected to oscilloscope, and I would be able to place that coil or Yagi antenna, but the Yagi antenna at 100 kilohertz would be tremendously long periodic, but that would be also a troublesome. So is it any other convenient way to find polarization?
Even at 100 kilohertz, every antenna can be squeezed down in physical size. When you do that, it's going to look like a solenoid coil with a capacitor across it. A solenoid coil with a capacitor across it that resonates at 100 kilohertz, in your example, is a magnetic loop antenna with multiple turns to it, which by building a pair of them and feeding a signal into one and checking the signal coming out of the other as you rotate it in polarization, you'd be able to measure how pure is its polarimetry characteristic. So a solenoid coil resonated is a polarimeter when you rotate it and make measurements. And when you do that, I'm pretty sure you're going to find out the signal coming out of your Tesla coil is 90-95% vertical, but there's going to be some horizontal component coming out of that primary winding out of the bottom of your Tesla coil. N2XJN, KQLIW.
Thank you very much for that help. The second question is making sure that the signal connected to the Tesla coil to the antenna is in right phase. So I have a vector voltmeter that works from 1 megahertz to up to 1 gigahertz. It's a little bit too high. But the thing is that I need to know what is the phase of the signal that is fitted into the antenna, and whatever the antenna it is. So one of the ways that I know is I'm punching the hole next to the connector to the antenna and injecting the probe from the vector voltmeter. Do you know of any other?
You got to be careful now with the word phase. Phase is a relative measurement. Somewhere in your system there is a reference signal. You call that zero phase if you want to. And somewhere else in the system you're making a measurement, and you want to find out that that second position has a signal that's advanced in phase or retarded in phase some number of degrees. Phase is a relative measurement. So you want to measure the phase between what and what. What are your two points of measurement of phase? That's question number one. The 8405 Hewlett-Packard vector voltmeter does go from 1 meg to 1 gigahertz. Its IF strip inside is running at, I think it's 60 kilohertz. So there's ways you could build a converter that tapped into that, or converted down to 60 kilohertz, and you could make a measurement at 100 kilohertz. But I think the internal IF, if you got the manual with it, the real internal mechanism is running at something like 60 kilohertz. So there's an oscillator beating your signal of measurement down to 60 kilohertz where the real measurements are made inside the machine. So with that knowledge, there's ways you could make a modification to your vector voltmeter so that you could make a phase measurement at 100 kilohertz. I didn't say it's easy, but you've got the technology to do that. N2XJN, K2IW.